You see, so I could call him back now?
Yeah, I'm going to get him on.
Hey, Mike.
Hey.
How you doing, buddy?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, the Raspberries are getting back together then. Is that exciting for you?
Oh, man, I tell you, it's made my day.
Hey, the news comes across the wire. The Raspberries are getting back together again, and I'm thinking, wow, there's something right there.
I had no idea. Well, so much for Kosovo, huh?
Not to write off the damn front page.
I think so. I think I don't think we have to worry about anything else. I mean, I just want to know where they're going to be playing.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you what. If you play your cards right, sir, I'm going to get you the first tickets because I'm going to be the official spokesman for the Raspberries.
Holy Toledo. That's choking me up, Johnny. Yeah. I don't know what to do about that.
Don't you worry about it, sir. I got a free book from you. That's the least I could do. I got the free book, The Long Sandy Hair of Neptune Zamora. That's a mouthful.
Yeah, well... That's, you know, when you move to Santa Fe, which is what I did a couple of years ago, you either got to move into a house made out of tires and go nuts and wear a lot of turquoise, or you got to write a book. So I decided to write a book.
Wait a minute, Mike. This, when I think of Santa Fe, I think of, and I'm probably wrong in this, but you said house made of tires.
Yeah.
I'm thinking Dennis Weaver.
Dennis Weaver? Well, okay, there's a good place to start.
Doesn't Hopper. He have like a house?
Hopper.
No.
No, Hopper built a house out of machine guns.
No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm talking Dennis Weaver. He has a house made of tennis shoes or something.
No, it's tires. It's old tires. He made his house out of old tires.
Yes.
I mean, I don't want to go off onto one of those things because it's, you go up there and you see those houses and they're actually kind of nice.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, you know, it's like the walls bounce.
Well, no, I know. I don't want to go off in one of those things either. All I'm saying is when I think of Santa Fe, you said house made of tires. Immediately, the image that popped into my head was Dennis Weaver.
Yeah,
I don't know why. But Santa Fe, they say, is just gorgeous, beautiful place.
Well, it's a pretty place. I mean, geologically, it's gorgeous. And, you know, it's got its share of squalor and strange fast food restaurant signs like every place else does these days. But I just I've always liked the country out here, and when I decided I wanted to do a little bit more prose writing, I thought this would be a good place to kind of get away. I still have an office in L.A., and I still come in there, and I still listen to your show, and I still do all the stuff that you have to do if you're an L.A.lian.
Yeah, you have to do that.
Yeah. But,
yeah, you have to do that.
But if, I get away from time to time, and I come out here. So tell me what it is with this resurgence of white blues. I don't understand this. It always made me uncomfortable when the Rolling Stones were doing it. It made me uncomfortable when Eric Clapton was doing it. And part of Neptune Zamora is this guy's finding a tape of an old blues player. I'm not tracking this. What's going on with this resurgence of white blues? Do you have to do that as you get older, or what?
You know what? Buzz, you're a blues player. How would you establish or explain why white guys like to do the blues?
Yeah, what's up with that?
Now, see, Buzz, there's no answer to that.
Uh-oh.
Gee whiz.
Yeah, there's no...
Come on now.
I can tell you this. It's easier to age with the blues than it is with rock and roll if you're a performer.
Well, there's something to that. I tell you, I was on, I've been on stages with people dressed up like Elvis impersonators.
Right.
And that's not a lot of fun. So being on stage with people playing the blues, I guess, is easier.
Yeah, I think, you know what it is? I think maybe the blues still has some sort of... melody to it. There's something you can get into. I mean, I'm telling you, some of the music today, I'm not with it. I can't get into it.
I've been listening on the internet to a radio station out of Sao Paulo, Brazil, and they've got this kind of mix of old samba and new hip-hop music and stuff. It's totally non-derivative of rock and roll. It's amazing how isolated we are in the States about, what's going on world music. The blues, you know, they were the underpinning of rock and roll and all, but it's sort of gone by the by. A whole new thing has come along, and why aren't you guys on the internet, by the way? I couldn't find this radio station on the internet.
CBS won't allow that.
Why?
You because they want it.
Get me on the phone to them. Who is that?
Okay, let me give you a name. Let me give you a name. Mike Nesmith, I'd like you to call Mr. Mel Karmazon. He's in New York, and just look it up and dial him up.
Okay, Mel, if you're listening, listen up. You're missing a boat, pal.
Now, wait a minute. Let's think about that for a second. Is he missing the boat when he could sell it? You see what I mean? Because if you put it out on the internet, people get it for free. I think that's what he's thinking, right?
Well, but people are listening to us for free right now.
Right, but the station in the market, you can't sell advertising on the internet. Well, I guess you can.
Sure you can.
Yeah, but not as much as you can here, or as much as they're trying to do anyway.
Not as much?
Yeah, believe me. Now, wait a minute, Mike. Back up to this for a second.
Okay.
Go ahead. You're calling the head of CBS, and you're telling them why they should be on the internet.
Well, because the internet is an emerging global network. It's a neural network. It's the way the whole planet is connected. Like I said, I was listening to Sao Paulo, and I've been kind of getting off on their playlist. It sounds to me, because I don't understand Portuguese, it sounds to me like it's like a 14-year-old's radio station. It's very bubblegummy, but it has a kind of a something to it going on. I listen to the Italian radio and so forth. You pick up these things on television. And what you're finding is that it's crossing cultural barriers. You're learning a lot of things that you don't know. And CBS and, you know, all the rest of the big media powerhouses in the United States should be right there leading that big connection charge.
Yeah.
The fact that it's a new economic model, you know, that's no big mountain to climb. You sell different kinds of ads or whatever, and you can make money off of it. It's true. It is a different economic model. But what you end up doing is leading the thought and learning stuff yourself. As you go along, you become a part of the global civilization that's emerging. You know, you can't just live off in, where does he live? You can't just live off in Southampton.
Listen, I'm not, I don't know where, I think he lives right in the city, but you know what? The bottom line is, I'm not arguing with you.
Yeah.
I agree. If you're an entertainer, you want to be heard by the most people you can be heard from, but you're doing it anyway. What would it hurt to be heard by someone in San Paulo, for God's sake? I don't care who hears it, but yeah. I'm just saying, I'm with you on that. And especially from a guy who, you know, was pretty much the inventor, the originator of, like, an MTV and some other stuff. So, and by the way, let's go back. You know, I heard Bob Pittman take credit for that.
Well, Bob Pittman deserves credit for that. Bob Pittman was the guy that ran it once we started it. He was, singularly responsible for its success.
Bob Pittman did not invent as what we know today as MTV, though.
No, he didn't think it up. But, you know, what I was over in Europe, and I kept seeing, say, there you are, Global Network.
Yeah.
I was over in Europe. I was wandering around because I had just done a video called Rio, looking at where they were playing these videos. They had half-hour television shows, and I thought, boy, 24 hours a day, that could be a really good television network. So I came back and sold it to Warner Brothers. He was working there. When Warner Brothers and American Express had a cable thing, he was working there selling movies for what's the name of the theater channel? Him and a guy named John Lack. And Bob is one of the brightest guys around. I mean, you know, he's a very astute, pulled-together guy. And I rolled the idea out to them, and he got it immediately, and it was, he put it on the map. All I did was sort of think it up and say, let's go do this.
Yeah, when you said you thought it up, though, what you said, here's what we're going to do. How did you think it up?
Well, when I came back from Europe and I'd seen these programs that played the clips, you know, like a half hour a day, I went in to see these guys, and I said, okay, look, here's some of the clips. Here's ones that I made. Why don't we put a music television up on the cable that you have and do it for 24 hours a day? And, you know, it'll be like music television. And so they said, well, we don't quite understand how that would work. So I said, I'll make a couple of pilots for you. And they ordered, like, I don't know, 5 or 10 pilots, something like that. And we ran them on Nickelodeon, which was another cable channel that they had.
Right.
And the cable channel that they had that had gone empty was an interactive experiment called Cube. I don't know whether you remember, it was out of Columbus, Ohio, like in 1917 or something.
No.
And it was unsuccessful. Nobody wanted to buy groceries off television. And so they had this empty transponder, which is the thing on a satellite that makes cable work, and it was costing them, you know, $12 million a year in rentals or something. And I said, why don't we put music up there, play these clips? And they said, well, are there enough of these clips to do it? I said, believe me, if we start broadcasting them, everybody will start making them. And they broadcast my clip, and they broadcast, oh, gosh, I can't remember. It was like a bunch of very strange people, you know, Debbie Boone and Paul McCartney with a bagpipe clip. And, I mean, it was very strange.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Very strange in the early going. Split Ends was together doing some stuff. And that's, you know, the first one of the first clips was Video Killed the Radio Star.
Video
you remember that?
Killed the Radio Star, yeah.
Yeah, who I can't remember. Buggles? Was that who that
Yeah, B-U-G-L-E-S, yeah, the Buggles.
So they said, all right, we'll do that. And actually, they asked me to stay there and work with them and run it, but I didn't want to be in a, you know, I didn't want to be a television exec, and I wanted to come back and do so. I came back to Monterey, which is where I was based, and I did a long-form video called Elephant Parts.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a video and started my little video company.
Yeah, they're, so you get nothing from this at all?
Well,
other than
paid.
The knowledge that Mike Nesmith had something, you got paid. You got paid for your idea?
I got paid for the idea. I got paid for the pilots that we did. Yeah. I got paid.
Well, yeah, I'm sure, by the way, one of the most.
But I didn't get $1 billion.
Right. You got that from PBS.
Wow, what about that, huh?
Holy smokes! Let me see if we got
this. There's a shocker.
Woo-wee! PBS, guilty of fraud, has to pay you and your company, what, 46, 47, what was it again?
Well, the judgment was 46.8.
$46.8 million in damages.
Yeah, it was a tough one, I tell you. And the weird thing about it, Johnny, these guys hit me. You know, I knew what they did, and I said, let's all just go home, bad play, bad form, very disappointed in you people. Go away.
Well, wait. Go back to what they did, Mike, because it was sort of like PBS and your company, was it Pacific Arts?
Pacific Arts.
Pacific Arts. You had some sort of a deal about video catalog, and I'm, you know...
Well, I had built, you know, after I started the video company with Elephant Parts in 1980, I just, over the years, I built a large video catalog. And that catalog became more and more valuable, and I thought, you know, what I want to do is market this under some kind of logo. So I called up PBS. I said, you guys thinking about getting in the video business? And they said, well, we can't really. We can't. We don't have a catalog, and I'm not sure we can own a catalog because of our status, and we don't know how to do it. And I said, all I want to do is license the logo. I've got all the videos that you're playing already on the air. I know these people, and I've got a nice, you know, setup here. License me your logo. I'll give you a nice... percentage of it, and you'll make some money, and you don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
I said, okay, that's a pretty good idea. So we started up, and it was a huge success. And one of the reasons it was a huge success was because Ken Burns did the Civil War. Do you remember the Civil
War?
And
the baseball thing, right?
Right, and he did that. It was a monster hit.
Right.
And it became a huge hit in home video. But the problem with it is that once he got on the boat, everybody at PBS started to pile on. So the boat started getting lower and lower in the water, and finally it started taking on water. And I said, you know, fellas, we can't sustain this level of growth. We're going to go broke here. We've got to make some kind of new deal. So they said, all right, we'll make a new deal with you. What do you want to do? And I said, well, what I want to do is sell the catalog. We've got a bunch of people that need to get paid now and so forth. Let me sell the catalog. We'll regroup. We'll redo the business. And what I didn't know is at the time that I was proposing that we do that, and they were saying, okay, good, we'll be your partner in that, we'll help you, you know, we'll let you license the logo to the new guy and whatever, they were plotting behind scenes to figure out a way to blow the company up so that they could get the catalog themselves, which, and, you know, all good bureaucracies do, they kept a nice, detailed paper trail of this. So... It happened. I mean, basically, they blew the company up. Basically, they got the catalog, and I knew they had done it, sort of. I mean, it was very carefully done, so I didn't exactly know how it was done. But my heart was broken. My business was devastated, and I thought, oh, I'm going to go write books. I'm going to move to Santa Fe. I'll play music. I'll write movies. I'll do all kinds of other stuff. I don't want to do this again. Time passes. I get sued. And they said, you remember all those debts that you were going to pay by selling the catalog? Well, you got to pay them. And I said, no. You got the catalog. I'm not going to pay these things. And they said, oh, no, you have to pay them because we have a document here that says you have to pay them. I said, fellas, if you push this, what will happen is I will tear your arm off and beat you to death. Because this is not, you have now crossed the bounds of ethics. And, you know, business without ethics is just crime. So you can't do this. I know what went on. And they said, we didn't do anything. And I went, oh, boy, I got one of these going. So I got a lawyer, a guy named Henry Gradstein, and his sidekick, or not his sidekick, but his partner, Bruce Van Dalsen. And they came in and they said, well, what are you going to do, sue Big Bird? Are you out of your mind?
The Cookie Monster versus the Monkey. I remember the headline.
Right.
The Cookie Monster versus the Monkey.
You're, and I said, but guys, I'm innocent here. I didn't do anything. They said, yeah, but PBS is, you know, this is like Uncle Bud. I mean, this is not anybody you want to mess with. This is, you know, this is a national asset. I said, I understand. But part of the national asset's playing fast and loose. And, you know, they're slugging at me, and they're going to take me out unless I defend myself.
Right. See, by the way, Mike, nobody knows that about it. I mean, it does look like, you know, so the headlines portray the Cookie Monster's after you, blah, 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 and you're going after this poor, innocent PBS. How are they going to be able to pay 46 point, whatever it is, $1 million to Mike Nesmith? How are they going to be able to do it? But your business is business, and they were doing something under the table, and they got caught.
Well, what they did was they stole, a multi-million-dollar asset. So, when the jury heard all this, you know, I said, look, all I want is my day in court. When the jury heard all this, their jaws dropped, and they said, oh, no, this doesn't play. You know, you got to pay this man for his business you took, and by the way, you're going to get punitive damages on top of that. And listen, you know, just for everybody to know, PBS has a $250 million asset base. You know, I can't take away anything from the local guys who ask for, you know, you to send in money for programming.
For that tote bag.
Right, but this is not them. You have to make a distinction between your local station and the big national PBS guys. This is a different thing. So, you know.
Well, can they pay? Have you received 1 cent yet? Or they fight? Is PBS going to fight Nesmith all the way down to the wire?
Well, it's fine with me if they do. I mean, they can't fight it all the way to the wire. It doesn't appear to be any appealable issues here. And you know, it was a very considerate trial, very stable jury. They were there the whole time. The judge was. would make moves that were very cautious and very thoughtful, I thought, and there's really no appealable issues there. PBS has hundreds of millions of dollars, and we're already going into a settlement conference. I don't want to hold these guys' feet to the fire. My comment that I made was, it's like finding your grandma stealing your stereo. You're glad to get the stereo back. You hate to find out grandma's a thief. Well, by the same way, I don't want to put grandma in jail. You
right.
know what I'm saying?
If you have to, though, you got to put grandma in jail.
Well, sometimes you got to say, grandma, yeah. leave the stereo alone.
There you go. Grandma, get your paws on my stereo.
Yeah,
you're going to prison.
What is up with you?
Yeah.
I mean, you could go listen to your Sade record on something else.
Sade. By the way, the other advantage that Mike Nesmith was saying about being on the Internet, and you can check out the website Mike's got at www.neptunezamora.com, Santa Fe, New Mexico. But wait a second. They're calling you in from, where are you calling from, Donna, Maryland?
Yes, Frederick, Maryland.
Yeah, see, now, right now, Mike, I'd be on in Maryland right now.
I see.
But, Donna, go ahead, speak to Mike Nesmith.
Hi, Mike. How you doing?
Okay.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Of all your accomplishments, what are you most proud of, and do you have any dreams you still hope to achieve?
Did you write for Tiger Beat magazine? I read that in Tiger Beat. He's done his first novel. Was that a dream, your first novel, the New Mexican road trip, the New Mexico road trip, the party, the blues cape that turns into some kind of weird sort of...
Scam.
Autobiographical, is it? Isn't it?
Huh? Well, I've done a lot of things. One of the reasons I do not play the blues is I have nothing to complain about. I mean, I'm a happy man.
Right.
I have a lot of good things that have happened to me, a lot of, bad things. You bury some good friends and...
Back up to that for a second, Mr. Nevis. Back up to the burying the good friends. You, Davy Jones, Peter Tork, Mickey. Is that the friends you're talking about?
Oh, no. I'm talking about real friends who are no longer with us, like Harry Nilsson and John Lennon.
But burying them, really burying them.
Oh, yeah.
Not saying goodbye to them, yeah.
Yeah, I'm talking about they're gone.
Yeah. So you guys...
those are sad moments, Those are, and I was just using it as an example to say, your life sometimes it gets unhappy.
Right.
But by and large, I have had a really great time.
Are
and
you
I intend to keep going. I mean, I just wrote a movie, and I'm doing, I'm writing Brazilian pop songs now.
Now you want to be out in San Paul. Unbelievable. Now, wait a second. Let me ask a couple of questions. This, the book, by the way, the first novel that Mike Nesmith has ever written, I believe I'm correct in saying that. Isn't that right, sir? That's your first novel, right?
Yes, correct.
Hold on a second once, because I want to make sure of one thing. Why are these people, where are they calling from? The Internet knows that you're on the line.
They must.
Yeah. Anyway, Michael Nesmith, the long sandy hair of Neptune Zamora.
Right.
When you read it, you'll understand it. But is this going to be the screenplay you wrote, or is this going to be the movie you wrote, or is it going to be something else? Because I just read where Repo Man is coming back.
Yeah, Repo Man was one of my finest hours. Also, you never saw a movie I made with John Cusack and Tim Robbins because it never got out, called Tapeheads. But that was a sensational flick. I made that with Brandon Tartikoff. No, what I'm going to do is a movie right now called Fried Pies.
Did you say fried pies?
Yeah, fried pies.
Fried pies, right.
Yeah, it answers the often asked question, why would anybody fry a pie?
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that in Neptune Zamora, I don't know whether you read it or not, that I started to realize happens to a lot of people, especially when I saw it with Elvis, is that they turn into these strange caricatures of themselves, which is, I call, running into your own personal Las Vegas. And I think it's embedded in all of us. We just get weird. I don't have any idea why Elvis started wearing rhinestones. How do you get from leather to rhinestones?
Yeah.
I think maybe there's something, genetic in the American culture that makes that happen. So I named it the America Gene, and I introduced it in Neptune Zamora. I'm writing a novel right now called The America Gene about a guy trying to avoid his own personal Las Vegas. And Fried Pies is sort of about... one of those little trips off to the side where a guy is, running down his own personal Las Vegas, which in his case happens to be an apricot fried pie.
I know this sounds very surreal. No, it is very surreal. You're very surreal, sir. is that a musical?
Yeah, it's got, like I say, it's got three Brazilian pop songs in it.
Yeah.
And, but no, it's not just a full-on musical.
Right. It's not the head of that fried cream pie.
That's right.
It's
fried
that.
Pie samba.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of musical numbers in there about, having to wait in a motif restaurant and buy a drink that you don't want in order to get a table.
Yeah.
And the thing that, What I'm trying to do with the whole thing is make a comedy about this particular passage of the America gene and how the whole Las Vegas thing comes into each of our lives. Are you guys turning into your own personal Las Vegas?
Yeah, I am. Absolutely.
See, the thing that happens is you get up in the morning, you look in the mirror, and you think, you know, that part's not that low.
Right.
Nobody's going to realize that I'm combing this over
right.
the bald spot. This
right.
looks okay, doesn't
yeah.
it? How does this look, Margaret? Does that look okay? And Margaret says, yes, dear, it looks fine. And, man, you are on your way to your own personal Las Vegas. You got an incipient comb over,
yeah.
and you're toast in just
yeah.
no time at all.
That's right.
And then you start picking out very, very strange things from golf stores to wear.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, you painted a real ugly picture. I can tell you that right now there, Mr. Nesmith.
Yeah.
You painted a really true life
it's
picture.
It's called Maturing in America.
Yeah. I'm telling you, folks, here's the name of the book, the first novel, The Long Sandy Hair of Neptune Zamora. And I want to ask you then, so the monkey movie, that's not going to happen? We got this fried pies possible. Monkey movie you were going to be doing?
I think the monkey's movie is toast. I don't, you know, we had a kind of a thing. Brandon Tartikoff, again, was going to be my partner in that, but Brandon died. So.
Wait. In the monkey movie?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I love Brandon Tartikoff. I don't know if you know. I love that man.
Yeah, he's a sweet guy. You know,
yeah.
we all miss him a lot. And he had a lot of really interesting and cool ideas. One of the things he came up with, he says, I own the rights to the Weekly World News. You
right.
know, the people who put the end of the world on the news. You know, you see him at the supermarket tabloids. He says, you think there's anything we can do with that?
Yeah.
I said, Brandon, I know exactly what to do with it. We make a monkeys movie out of it. So it was going to be the monkeys go to a place in Weekly, Mississippi, where the local news show is the Weekly World News, but all that stuff is real.
You know, it's wild. Mike, the pitch I heard with that was that he wanted to take the Weekly World News.
Yeah.
The guy brings the headlines, he reads the headlines,
right.
and then the story is created
right.
in that half hour, whatever it was called, drama, comedy, whatever you call it.
Well, that was his TV show.
Yeah, believe me, I heard it.
And what we were going to do was take the same dynamic, excuse the word, and we were going to use it as a monkeys movie, you know,
yeah.
because the monkeys were a fiction of television that came to life, much
yeah.
to everybody's surprise. And sort of like the Weekly World News, all that stuff is fiction, but a lot of it just comes to life. So you got to ask yourself, you know, what comes first?
Are you and Davey and Peter, are you guys mad at each other? We kind of zip past that. Are you guys talking? Have you spoken? Will you speak again?
Well, I haven't talked to any of the guys in a while. We went on tour in England three years ago, and that was a singularly unpleasant experience.
And why was that?
Well, I wasn't interested in it. There was no creative return, and I sort of, you know, my spirits flagged, and I thought, I just don't want to sing this and do this anymore.
But you didn't know that until you got out there and it started
really
to hit you?
No, I didn't. And there's only a handful of people that can play rock and roll at the stadium level anyway, and the kind of the regrouped monkeys did that on a little bit of a basis. We played Wembley, you know, in England, and there were a lot of people there. There was great approval and a lot of love shared and people applauding that loved the old songs and stuff. But, you know, after a while I thought, I can't do this. You know, I'm 93 years old.
Right, 92.
Okay, 92.
Right.
And I just have other things to do with my thinking than to stand up here in a velvet suit and, and sing these songs again. So the creative return was kind of zip. And that was the worst part of it. Whereas I'm on the set like of... I don't know, insert movie here, like a Repo Man, and you're dealing with these minds like Alex Cox and Jonathan Wax and Peter McCarthy, and, you know, they're making this movie up as you're going along, and you realize you're in the presence of something seminal and very good.
It just creatively gets you more juiced up than going
exactly.
on stage. Right. You probably, it sounded like probably a good idea to you, but it's interesting to hear you say when you got out there, you went, I don't know about this. You
yeah,
kind of started to feel it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I've always been, you know, friendly with the guys. It's a professional relationship because it was born of television, and so it was never a friend, you know, it was never organic. But the, there wasn't any basis to continue on. So I'm not going to go back and do that again. I can't think of any reason that I would do it. David didn't want to do the movie. I was going to do the movie, and David didn't want to do the movie, so it all just sort of cratered. And I haven't talked to him like in 3 years.
Yeah, that's right. He was on the show, and he said that you didn't want to do. I could have sworn you didn't want to do the movie. Why didn't he want to do the movie?
I don't know.
I don't remember even asking him that question.
It's all a mystery.
Yeah, well, it sounds like a mystery you don't really much care about anymore.
Well, I mean, there goes Kosovo.
Yeah, there goes again. Once again, our top story: the Raspberries are reuniting, and Mike Nesmith has a book out. called, once again, ladies and gentlemen, The Long Sandy Hair of Neptune Zamora. Check it out. It makes sense when you read it on the internet, www.neptunezamora.com. I'm sure that one day we'll read that Mike Nesmith also owns the internet. You probably do own the internet, don't you?
Well, I've got VideoRanch.com and NeptuneZamora.com. That's as far as I've made it.
Wait a minute. VideoRanch.com and NeptuneZamora.com. What is the difference between the two?
Click on and you'll find out.
I'm going.
And right now, you know, we're circling Brazil.
Yeah, but can you do me one other favor?
Go ahead.
Charles Manson never auditioned for the Monkees. Just admit, Mike Nesmith, if you say it, someone will absolutely believe it.
To my knowledge, Charles Manson never auditions for the Monkees.
You have your right hand raised?
I have my right hand raised.
Are you telling me the truth, or you're doing a PBS on me?
No. PBS does PBS.
Oh, that's right. All
I
right.
I did Grandma Steals the Stereo.
Yeah, Charles Manson couldn't have been, because they always say, Stephen Stills, yes, that's a true audition. Stephen
yeah,
Stills
Steve,
audition.
Steve
yeah.
came down for that.
Right, but Charles Manson never auditioned for the Monkees.
No, and thanks for playing Who's There Anyway, but it's not true.
We'll play again next week, Name That Urban Legend, with Mike Nesmith. Mike, we look forward to seeing your next movie, whatever that may be. Have some fun.
Johnny.
And call us anytime, sir.
Thanks for all the time.
The one and only Mike Nesmith. Thank you, Michael.
Bye.
Mike Nesmith. He's way, 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 way out there. The new book. Available now in bookstores everywhere.
You're listening to Jonathan Brandmeier.